Thinking Basketball Podcast. My name is Ben. Welcome back to another playoff episode. Cody, how you doing?
Man, we are full force in the playoffs. We have our first winner in the first round. That's very exciting. I'm not sure if people had filled out the betting markets, who they thought would get out of the first round first. I don't think many people would have picked Minnesota, but here we are. And I don't know. There's a lot of other rounds or games or series that have to wrap up. Did you know, Ben, that the plural of the word series is series? Maybe that's obvious, but in my mind, I always wanted to say series. But then it's not right to me. It's not right.
This is a conundrum a young writer faces that I grappled with many years ago. And you just have to accept that series and series are the singular and plural of that word. I'm more fascinated by rays and rays being antonyms of each other, but sounding exactly the same.
Do you raise rays and rays?
See what I did to you?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Exactly.
Well, wasn't there a dictionary update when they said that literally both means figurative and literally?
Yes.
If you look it up, those are the two definitions. That's unacceptable.
It literally does.
No, that
I just quantum worded you right there. Let's talk basketball. Well, okay. The Suns. Should we pour one out for the Suns? What should we do with? We have been interested in super teams forever around these parts. I basically talked about fit and super teams and redundancy in a book that I once wrote. That was so long ago. Thinking Basketball, the book. I can't even remember half of what's in that thing, but I do know I talked about that. And this year, there's these three super team experiments, if you will, quote unquote. If you're not watching on YouTube, I'm doing the air quotes, which I kind of just made look like some sort of crab claw creature right now. You have the Suns, where they have a big three, very top heavy, no one else. And they literally constructed the team like this through trades and whatnot. Then you have the Clippers. We've talked about them a little bit, and I think we'll get to them because they're in the middle of an incredible series right now with the Dallas Mavericks. That Cody, when you watch this series, does it take years off your life? I'm so tired by the end of the third quarter of every game in this series that I can barely even make it through the fourth. We'll get to that. And then, of course, your Milwaukee Bucks. We might have to pour one out for them as well. They're down 3-1 as of recording this. They're going to play the injury card. People are going to play and fall back on the injury card, but it has been a bumpy experiment in Milwaukee. Again, whether they're a classical super team, Lillard, Giannis, I don't know if there's a big three, Chris Middleton, does he qualify, what's going on there? But all this team construction stuff is really interesting. And if we just start with Phoenix, who, to use the TNT vernacular, has now gone fishing for the summer. I don't think either you or I ever bought into. I was waiting. We were waiting at the beginning of the season to see what they look like, to see if they could fulfill this idea of the role players coming around. The Brooklyn Nets a couple years ago, 2021, with their big three, I thought really empowered the role players because the three stars were so good and so skilled offensively. And you just got a situation in Phoenix where every time you looked at it, you're like, oh boy, Josh Okogie and Grayson Allen and center DeJour playing big minutes is just not going to cut it. Plus the things we've talked about over the season and more recently with how those three stars, they all have skills that fit really well with other players and other ball dominant players, but they're they all have the exact same set of strengths and weaknesses. And it just lands with this really weird, three starters that can't really defend, that can't really pass. So the idea of them being a primary playmaking hub kind of goes to the wayside in the playoffs. And then they love the mid-range and shooting from the outside, and none of them could put any pressure on the rim. And when you drop that in a 2024 playoff environment, especially against the Minnesota Timberwolves, it's a recipe for disaster.
I'll admit that at the beginning, I think in the preview pod at the beginning of the season, I experimented. I was a little curious with the Suns. I was Suns curious. I thought maybe they could be a top three, top two seed or whatever else. But then the struggle with it throughout the entire season is you just never saw it all together. There were random blips where all three of the guys would play. You'd see here's a 20-minute section of Beal, Durant, and Booker being on the court together. And sometimes you're like, okay, this is a functional offense. This is a really tough team. Maybe it's going to work out. Maybe when this guy's on the bench, this guy's going to step up and do really well. But you just never saw it, and we never really got comfortable. I don't think you and I ever really did the full-blown Suns treatment during the season because we just never felt comfortable enough analyzing this team. But then I think the huge issue here is kind of like the 2011 Miami Heat syndrome, where you get your big stars, and obviously like those stars in 2011, Dwayne Wade, Chris Bosh, LeBron James, were at their peak, right? Like these guys were absolutely incredible. The Suns group, like Kevin Durant's 10 years older than that. But at that point for the Heat, they're just like, hey, Mike Bibby, does he still play? Send him a contract, right? They were just giving contracts to anyone they could. And that's kind of how it felt for the Suns team. They just cobbled together all these other parts. A lot was hinging on Grayson Allen, whom, watching closely as a Bucks fan when he played, I just knew when we get to the playoffs, I know he went down injury. We can play the injury card there too, but not a guy that's going to move the needle a ton for a playoff team. But then just the size in general, the physicality down low, like Yusuf Nurkic, he looks good at regular season minutes at times with his passing. He can maybe defend the rim sometimes. Drew Eubanks was getting not as many minutes as I expected based on how Nurkic was playing in the playoffs. I don't know. It's just the shell around these guys was not filling the gaps in the way that they needed to really amplify what they could do for each other. And I really think that's the major fault of the team.
I don't think it's the easiest gaps to fill when those are your strengths and weaknesses. Because if you were to make like a matrix or a checkbox of attributes that these guys bring to the table, I think it's all, you get one of them, you get all of them. You could start with Durant, and then Booker and Beal don't necessarily add anything. They all have very, very similar strengths and weaknesses. I think one thing that's underrated here is that Durant is just older. He's done amazing work post Achilles injury. But one of the things that I got a lot of flack for, but I harped on back when we were doing, you know, 20 top 10 lists in 2021 and 2022 and years like that, is like he is not driving as much as he was when he was younger. And that's to be expected post Achilles. And I feel like you're seeing a little bit of that physicality slowing down and taking its toll. Especially as the officiating has allowed the players to be more physical. I mean, that's another thing, right? I don't know if you want to jump into that right now, Cody, but I go from series to series and I look at the roster and how the team plays, and then specific players, and I'm like, okay, are you going to get hurt and chipped away at because they allow more contact, just in particular on drives? Like they're allowing the defensive player to slide and exist in front of ball handlers. You have to actually go around someone now. Is that going to change how you play as an individual? Does that take away your strengths as a star? Does that take away your strengths as a team? I certainly don't think that helped Phoenix in any way whatsoever, especially against such a big physical defensive team like Minnesota in the first round, where it's like, we did the video, they had trouble bringing the ball up the court. It's just like, all right, dribbling is a hazardous red zone near Nikhil Alexander Walker. Did I say I bought some Nikhil Alexander Walker stock earlier in the year? Can I buy 10 more shares of Nikhil Alexander Walker? That guy's such a great defender. You get Anthony Edwards with these possessions. Obviously, Jaden McDaniels, Rudy Gobert at the rim. Wait a second. What's is that? Rudy Gobert's music? Hold on, Cody. I think I hear Rudy Gobert's music. Cody, would you like to take the mic and come back? We're gonna do our season prediction, our season award prediction recount show at some point coming up when the awards are all counted. But Cody, you have been not only vocal before the Rudy Gobert trade, but one of the people on this podcast who picked Rudy Gobert to win Defensive Player of the Year. Back when people said you're crazy, you can't pick Rudy Gobert to win Defensive Player of the Year. He's fallen out of favor, and oh, how the times have changed. The floor is yours, sir.
I want to go back to not even last summer, the summer before when the trade actually happened for Gobert, and it seemed like the tides were Timberwolves paid way too much. Like, they way overpaid for somebody like Rudy Gobert. This is an insane trade. They kind of leveraged. They got rid of their entire future. It's over, right? They should have just banked it all on Anthony Edwards and built around them. But we're talking about a team here in the Timberwolves that, I don't know if people know, probably you've heard it said on some kind of broadcast, but the Timberwolves haven't won a playoff series in 20 years. And that was my perspective going into that trade. It's like, listen, this is a team that is starving for some kind of postseason success. And when you are a team like the Timberwolves that's not going to be scoring huge free agent signings, right? You're not going to have guys that's going to be like, you know what? I'd love to go live in Minneapolis, which, by the way, as somebody that does live right outside of Minneapolis, great city. It's beautiful here. Winter sucks, but that's just one thing. Anyway, when you only have two playoff series victories in your entire franchise history, you really have to go out there and make some swings. And Rudy Gobert, multiple-time defensive player of the year, best rim protector possibly of the entire century, that's the kind of guy you swing for. And he, as far as I'm concerned, answered all kinds of questions in this series. I mean, you talked about it in the video, but even in Game 4, after your video comes out, he's out on the perimeter. He's shutting down the rim completely. Guys are clearly afraid of getting to him. Like, you have a team in the Suns, like you just said, that are afraid of driving to the basket already. Not afraid. They're not capable compared to some of these other teams that get into the basket. And Rudy Gobert just completely changes that for them. So I think he sort of anchors everything that they're able to do defensively. And then you just unleash the hounds of Anthony Edwards, Jaden McDaniels, Naw. Like, it's unbelievable what this Timberwolves team has done. And I think they have now jumped up to being my team I'm most interested to watch the rest of the playoffs.
Ooh, tell me more about that. So you are looking forward to the bloodbath with Denver coming up.
Oh my God, absolutely. Ben, yeah. Did you see, this is on topic here, so just bear with me for a second. Did you see like the 2020 Mortal Kombat remake by chance?
I didn't see the 1995 Mortal Kombat. Okay. Yeah, I have no idea. Is that, it's a movie.
Yeah, okay.
I didn't see it.
Okay. No. So, bad movie, by the way. It's terrible. But there's a couple things that are great. Number one, any scene that Sub-Zero is in, right? Dude that shoots ice out of his hand and freezes people. Shea Serrano, back when he was a writer for The Ringer, made a comment that the fight scenes with Sub-Zero were so good because he fights with like a certain level of violence that you don't see actors bringing. And that's just the way the Timberwolves play. And the violence kind of has like a malicious term behind it. But that's all I can keep thinking about when I watch them, is they play with such a ferocity that I just don't know how other teams are going to adjust to that. Not saying the teams can't adjust to it, but I think they're going to raise the level of aggression that any team is going to play them with. And I just want to see like how far they can ramp that up. So that's part of the main reason, is like, here's a team that is so bought into defense, right? Obviously, they have Rudy Gobert in the center, like I just said, but then some of the best perimeter defenders straight up in the league. We talked about all of them on the Thinkies. I don't know. That, if we go back to the statement that defense wins championships, let's stress test that. Like, let's see how far the Timberwolves are able to ride that into the sunset here.
It's done.
Connor McDavid! It's not real!
The goal of the year.
Panarin!
Part of the past. The celebrations. Forgotten. The history.
Vegas Golden Knights!
History. Win. We're back to a blank slate. Clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
I'm going to put you on the spot.
Hmm.
I believe in our playoff preview, you selected Minnesota as the team most likely to knock off Denver in the Western Conference. Am I remembering that correctly?
I said the Thunder, I think.
Oh, okay. All right.
I think I said the Thunder were. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I think the Timberwolves would have been like the second best.
All right.
Out of the bunch, though. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, we'll get to the Thunder in a second then. Okay. I want to know, after you've seen this series against Phoenix, you've also seen four games of the Nuggets and the Lakers, are you feeling more confident in Minnesota's ability to defeat Denver in a seven-game series it's going to be in the second round here?
I was sitting with somebody, with a Minneapolis individual a couple weeks ago.
A Minneapolis individual.
Yeah, yes. Before the playoffs started. Okay. And that person was like, I'm not worried about Denver. I'm like, what are you talking about? You're not worried about that. They're like, not worried about Denver. We go into the playoffs and we face them. We got them. We got them beat. I'm like, that's nonsense. I'm not saying I flipped. I think I would still pick Denver in that series, but that might be like as close of a coin flip that I can think of. Like, I'm pretty impressed, but also am I just like biased because they didn't face Jokic? Like, it was Yusuf Nurkic in the paint and not Nikola Jokic. Like, that's going to be an enormous change. It's going to be very different kinds of guys that they have to defend. But they were just so on a string defensively. Like, some of the ways that they were able to fly around the court and throw out all these different kinds of coverages. I don't know, man. As a defense truther, it's hard not to be infatuated with this Timberwolves team.
Well, they're really fun and they're really good. And I think the big question still is that offense in a playoff setting. The late game offense throughout the season obviously had a lot of problems in close games. They rely a lot on Anthony Edwards in those situations. Anthony Edwards is just about as fun as anybody to watch at certain times in the NBA right now. But, you know, the combination of decision making and ability to generate easy shots is still not at the level you want for, like, hey, I'm going to rely on this guy to run championship offense down the stretch of a big playoff game. So it's the big question. Denver, I think the only question I can see with Denver is maybe Jamal Murray's ankle health or something like that. He's got a calf strain that, I mean, he may very well not miss any games in the playoffs, but his shot has been way off. I have no idea if that has anything to do with some of those ankle issues that he's fought through on and off throughout the season. I think both ankles, if I recall correctly, it's just been a sprain festival. There's one game, I think we did a show right afterwards. There's one game where he sprained his ankle like two or three times in the same game. He kept coming back and spraining his ankle to different degrees. So otherwise, I think what we're looking at in the next round, and this is what's so hard to do, Cody, when you try to forecast and analyze playoff basketball. Your sample in front of you, when we watch the first round and we say Minnesota, Phoenix, and everything we've been talking about for the last 20 minutes, that's just one team. That's the sample of one. You get four games, you get seven games, you get different plays and the pick and roll and drop coverage, pick and roll against switch. You get variety there, but it's the same team in front of you. And now you have to shift your mentality and you have to go, what does this look like against Denver? First of all this nonsense with not being able to dribble the ball in the paint, that probably goes away because you have Nikola Jokic. So starting right there, you just flip everything. Secondly, I think the offensive versatility, the firepower, the breadth, the strength, everything between a kind of broken Phoenix. Phoenix is like a buggy coming down the road that someone tried to assemble with three really pretty parts from a Ferrari or something, and they couldn't stick it together. And then the whatever the Nuggets are is like a machine from another galaxy. It came in, it like defies the laws of physics, it all works together. It's just like a perfectly balanced ecosystem that takes you anywhere. That's what the Nuggets are. They are an incredible machine as a five-man unit without really weaknesses. Aaron Gordon in the dunker spot, his power, his size, his extra passing, Murray and Jokic two-man game, Kentavious Caldwell-Pope. And now, what is going on? Have you seen Michael Porter Jr. literally playing the best basketball I've ever seen him play? I know the MPJ truthers say, you know, before the back stuff and he was a little more fluid, he could have been even more as an overall basketball player. But certainly since the end of his Missouri tenure, where he struggled with his back and he's kind of become the three-point specialist and this big guy who can influence the defensive glass and rim protect a little bit. Cody, he's played like two or three of the best all-around games I've ever seen him play on defense and as a passer just within that offense. And then, also, he's just dropping like 20, 30 points a night because the shooting and the shot making are there. This is what's coming potentially in the next round.
So that is the interesting part. Because when you think about the Suns, that's a much more traditional way to defend a team. It's like, okay, we have Devin Booker, we have Kevin Durant, we have Bradley Beal in front of us. Good. We have Nikhil Alexander-Walker, we have Anthony Edwards, we have Jaden McDaniels. Let's just go. We can play some ones.
There's a one-to-one perimeter kind of fit there in terms of the offense-defense matchups.
Exactly. But like when you look at the Nuggets, you look at like Kentavious Caldwell-Pope. Like, what are you going to do defensively to stop just like running around and being open in the quarter? Or like MPJ, like you were just talking about, shooting the lights out, doing all these crazy things. How are you going to contest a guy that's 6'10" that just is uncontestable, right? He's just going to get that shot off all the time. Jamal Murray playing that two-man. Like, you have to be so locked in a way that you just don't have to play defense against any other team in the NBA. And so it is a style matchup where it's like, okay, we have this incredible team that showed us some of the best defense we've seen. Yeah, probably the best defense we've seen in all of the playoffs right now from the best defense in the NBA from the regular season. How does that translate to playing this like weird transcendent style of basketball where it's just like people are moving, you have the hub of Nikola Jokic in the middle? So I'm not really sure, but I don't know. I'm just not sure, because even Anthony Davis, like we talk about how great of a defensive player he is, Jokic is still like feasting. He's doing his thing out there. Is Rudy Gobert going to look different? Like, I thought Gobert looked pretty solid defending him last year, but I still contend Jokic was a little injured in the first round of last year's playoffs. There's something with his finishing. There's something going on with his hand a little bit. I'm just not sure. I think this is going to be a really fascinating series, but if you had to make me pick, I'm still taking the Nuggets in this series. Even though, is it preemptive that we're picking the Nuggets and not the Lakers in a 3-1 comeback? I mean, LeBron isn't, he hasn't shied away from 3-1 comebacks in his career.
Well, it would be a 3-0 comeback, which of course has never been done. Very rare to even get to game 7 when you're down 3-0. Also, the Nuggets had defeated the Lakers 11 straight times before that. I'm not sure if you're aware of that. So if you want to like weigh some prior evidence into that equation, I think it's pretty safe to say that the Nuggets are going to be the matchup against Minnesota. I have a theory. I have a thought that's been percolating. I apologize in advance. It's about Jokic and Anthony Davis.
Ooh.
And I want to take it and see if we can apply it to the potential Minnesota matchup or maybe any other matchup. I'm not sure. Basically, this is the second straight year where Anthony Davis has played really well in the playoffs. He looks really good. He might look physically better this year than he did last year in the playoffs. He's just been great. What that has meant in every other matchup, including play-in tournament games, single elimination games, and going back to 2020, the bubble, is that Davis can basically take away your best weapon on offense, dictate the terms of the battle when you have the ball on offense. I mean, just this idea that like, well, we're going to funnel all the Warriors shooters into Anthony Davis, and you're going to be perfectly okay with that. It's kind of remarkable when you think about it. That's just the defensive side of the ball. You look at the offensive side of the ball, he's doing this silly thing that he does where you get into the postseason and all of a sudden he can make jumpers again. I don't know. NASA needs to investigate this. I don't know what's going on. So if you pull it up once again in this series, Anthony Davis, very good passer rating for him, very good offensive performance, 27 points per 75, plus 11% true shooting. It's just like deja vu. It's the exact same thing. The difference for me here, Cody, with the Nuggets, is it feels like so much of that value that he provides in every other playoff setting against every other team. I don't want to use the word neutralized, like it completely goes away, like he's a neutral player, but playing Jokic, he kind of takes away a lot of that value because, first of all, you lose that magical sort of cheat code ability on defense that we've talked about over the years that he provides in a series. It just goes away. Like, he's still a good defender, but you can't be like, throw Davis into the Nikola Jokic situation, throw a wrench in that, and muck it all up. Nope, doesn't work. Let's have Davis be a roamer. Yeah, okay, whatever. It doesn't derail the system that is the Nuggets. And then even on the other end, it's like, great, he's hitting his jumpers and he's putting up big numbers, but he's never been an offensive centerpiece that can just like, you know, dominate you and dominate his opponent in the sense that, well, maybe he gets something back against Jokic because Jokic is a weaker defender. Nah, I don't know. I think he's going like 27 plus 10 against anybody, and it just doesn't seem to do much. So my theory here is that there's this fascinating style that the Nuggets play, particularly on offense, that is this neutralizing force against Anthony Davis. And if we just peek down the road here, the next team he's playing is a Rudy Gobert-led defense. So I rambled for a while there. What do you think about all this?
So you're wondering, based on all this, if somehow the style the Nuggets have is going to make, I'm going to use your word, even though it's not the word we're sticking with, maybe neutralize some of the incredible defensive impact that Rudy Gobert brings to the court.
In essence, yeah. I mean, you were alluding to it when you were saying you don't defend the Nuggets with these one-to-one defensive matchups. You don't say, if you want to run it through Booker and Durant, we've got Naw and, you know, Jaden McDaniels for you. And one. By the way, a lot of people in Minnesota are saying J-Mac is Jordan McLaughlin. No, You got to be better than that to get that nickname. That nickname should be Jaden McDaniels. Jaden McDaniels should be J-Mac. They call him Big Mac. This is ridiculous. What if Jordan, what if he doesn't, what if he goes overseas for 10 years? And then in 25 years, they're saying like, who are the great, Michael Cooper and Bruce Bowen and Big Mac. He likes McDonald's. I mean, no, he should be J-Mac. Anyway, yes, that's what I'm getting at, Cody. There's something about the way they play, the combination of on and off ball movement, the decision making, the spacing on the court, the fact that the ball can touch Murray and Jokic kind of interchangeably as part of exactly what they want to do, and they just, they're always looking for the best shot. So how do you take away that pressure point defensively? Look, I think Minnesota's a great defense. I think they have a great ability to defend them going forward. It's going to be fascinating. But yeah, I do kind of wonder if some of the magic sauce that we just saw against Phoenix gets neutralized in the same way that I think if the Lakers played someone else in the first round, we would feel a lot different about the Lakers as they were potentially storming through an upset into the second round.
The only thing I can think of is, you know, drawing from some of the clips that you have in your Timberwolves defense video, Jaden McDaniel, I don't even know what to call him anymore. I almost feel like he should have like a real nickname, like the Octopus or something like that. I don't know if you would dig that. We need something to just talk about how incredibly long this guy is. But he has an impossible contest in the video you have. Just an impossible contest. I forgot who it was that is shooting in that possession, but it's like a last second thing. He's defending somebody in the corner. Here's the person that's up a little bit more right on the wing. And he's just like there and he high fives the guy. It might be, is it Bradley Beal?
I think it's Beal.
Yeah, I think it's Beal. High fives him. And when you watch the beginning of the jump shot, you're like, there's no possible way he gets there. Anthony Edwards has another contest. Just a pogo stick of a jumper. He's just like here. And all of a sudden he's like, all right, I'm going to jump up and contest. It's like, that was shockingly closer than it probably should have been. And so I don't know if these guys who can maybe fly around the court a little bit more can get to and contest some of these shots that Jokic is going to create for everyone else a little bit more. And I guess like that's where the defense is going to be stressed, is how quickly are you going to be able to recover out to the perimeter? Something about Anthony Edwards I want to bring up that's really fascinating to me about him is right now he kind of seems to be, and I think there's a video coming out soon about Jalen Brunson and the lineage of Allen Iverson.
It's out now. Oh yeah.
This is incredible. So the lineage of these small point guards who are just the offensive centerpiece on a defensive minded team, even like Derrick Rose, like the early 2010s Bulls or another team like this. Anthony Edwards is kind of like that, but he's actually a little bit different because Anthony Edwards, unlike those other guys, adds to the defense. Like when you see these other superstar offensive players, they're not necessarily adding. I'm not saying Jalen Brunson is taking away much from defense, but just because of his size and physical gifts, he's not really giving you much defensively. Anthony Edwards is adding to the Timberwolves. And I can't think of many other stars that are like that, that sort of in that team build while actually contributing to the defense. And I think that's a really fascinating push and pull because you can't play him off the court. It's not like, all right, we're going to get their best offensive player off the court by taking advantage of his defense because he's a strength there. So I think that makes Anthony Edwards a really cool build on this team. It's cool. This Timberwolves team is so cool, Ben.
Yeah.
It's so cool.
Yeah. LeBron has that a little bit, I think, in the sort of lineage of heliocentric players.
Yes.
Right? Magic Johnson, Oscar Robertson, Steve Nash, guys just having the ball and doing a lot. Tiny Archibald. I'm trying to think of sort of the historical ones before we get into modern spread pick and roll. And of course, James Harden and Luka Doncic and on and on and on and on. And I don't really think I listed a decent defender in that group. But then you get to LeBron, who of course could play that way at his heyday, dominate the ball, get me shooters around me, spread pick and roll, pick and pop, et cetera, et cetera. But then on the other end, changes the dynamic of your team construction so much because he's not a negative defender, in his case, a massively positive defender when he was at his best. So I think there's some similarities there. That's an interesting idea. Do you have more to add to that?
No, but you said two names that I don't know if it's a good transition because in your little helio, you brought up one Luka Doncic and one James Harden.
Oh my goodness. Yes.
Do you want to try and unpack this series, Ben?
That's a professional segue.
Yeah.
I'm glad you mentioned this, and my goodness, we still have to talk. You mentioned Brunson. I thought we were going to go right into Knicks and Sixers. We still have to talk about that, but yeah, those have been the two best series to me, Knicks and Sixers, which we'll get to in a second. and the Clippers and the Mavs, and just trying to make sense of this Clippers-Mavs series. As of recording this, and I would not be surprised at all if the Mavs win the series in six, based on what we know. So we record this, win, we move on, and this just feels like a weird sort of footnote that's stuck in time for 48 hours or something. But as of recording this, the Clippers are 2-0 without Kawhi Leonard in this series. They're 0-2 with Kawhi Leonard in this series. He came back in game three. He looked, I mean, if we put him on the Embiid scale, like, okay. He looked like 50%. You're like, all right, maybe he's getting his feet wet, something like that. You know what I'm saying? What, you're making a face.
Did he look 50%?
In the third game, I thought. No, the fourth game, this is where I'm going. The fourth game was like, it's 0%. The fourth game was 0%. I think I asked our group, no one had the chutzpah to respond. No one was brave enough to take on this question. I think I asked the group, Kawhi's game four, between like a 0 to 100 scale or a 1 to 100 scale, between like a replacement player and a Hall of Famer, where was that game? Because the answer I was looking for, Cody, was like 0 to 1. He was just out there taking up space. And I never thought I would see that. It was one of those things where you don't want to get into the medical side of it, but I just, in retrospect, he probably should not have been playing from a functional standpoint. He didn't help the team. Then they shelve him for the next game, then go right back to where they were in game one with this like fierce defensive, like Russell Westbrook, multiple steals on just like little entry passes. He's like, I'm going to get that ball. I am Avery Bradley all of a sudden. What's happening? Changing the identity of that team, both Paul George and James Harden taking on more clearly defined offensive responsibilities in that game, because in the third game, the offense was just totally broken. And I don't know if that was having Kawhi out there, having Westbrook out there. One of the things they've done in this series, being Dallas, is they've ignored Westbrook a lot and really penalized him when he's off ball as a shooter. So the Clippers are kind of playing 4-on-5, something we've seen a ton in this latter part of his career. But man, the last game, James Harden, I mean, I know you want to get into that because your segue was Harden and Luka. That was the floater, the mid-range, the middle game. Sign me up. That was amazing.
So before the playoffs started, I was a Mavericks guy. I think we're on opposite ends here. I think I picked the Mavericks, you picked the Clippers. And I'm actually more confused about the series than before the series started. Like, I thought I had more clarity before it started because, yeah, you just said you wouldn't be surprised to see if did you say if the Mavericks won the series?
Yes.
In like
exactly.
Six, is that where we're
yes.
Trending? I don't even know what to think anymore, because my whole thing was look at the size and length of a lot of these wing guys that the Mavericks have. They can throw all these guys, especially if Kawhi Leonard's out, like that would have completely changed the calculus. Throw all these wing guys at them, they'll be able to slow them down. But then you see all these possessions with like PJ Washington out on James Harden, and James Harden pretended he wasn't even there. Right, and I thought James Harden was at a point in his career where he just wasn't going to have the burst. Not when the physicality of the playoffs came, he'd really have a hard time getting into the paint. But he was kind of getting into the paint whenever he wanted, and it really broke my heart, Ben, to think about the Rockets James Harden, who completely pushed aside like mid range and float game type of stuff because he's so good in that area. You go back to the OKC games days when he's coming off the bench, he uses that mid range game quite a bit more. Even the early Rockets days, he's pulling up from mid range, he's snaking his way in and getting those shots. And now that he's bringing it back out again, you're like, man, this guy's float game is so good. It's kind of befuddling what the Mavericks are doing here. I don't know. I mean, I know Paul George kind of owned the first half with his ridiculous shot making, but my main note in that second half, and especially that fourth quarter, was James Harden just getting into the paint and scoring over and over the same looking shot there. And I just kind of expected the Mavericks to be able to stay in front of him a little bit better, especially when the chips were down.
It's only four games, Cody, so I don't want everyone to get too excited. But James Harden is second in our playoff model. In box plus minus. In the whole league, he's second. Jokic is always first, by the way, if you're ever wondering. Like, he's obviously just first in everything we ever run. It's kind of starting to get annoying. But no, he's really just been fantastic in many areas. The mid-range shooting is off the charts right now. And this is yet another thing that we've mentioned before over the years. but it's kind of subtle and maybe lost in the chaos right now. More defense, more physicality suppresses the overall scoring. We talked about defensive offensive rating. Let's try that again. We talked about defensive rating sitting at 110, or offensive rating. They're the same thing when you talk about league average. We talked about offensive rating sitting at 110 in the playoffs, where we've been up at this 115 to 117 range for the last like 2 years. You know what that does? It makes the mid-range shot more valuable. It makes your 50% pull-up in that intermediate area in a half-court possession, where the half-court possession is harder to score. Look at the score of some of these games. In the 90s, struggling to get over 100. All of a sudden, you hit like 4, 5, 6, 7 mid-rangers as a counter to how the defense is playing you. It makes that shot more valuable. One of the reasons we've had to see, or one of the reasons why you need that counter, is because the Mavs have Dikembe Mutombo. I mean, Derek Lively. What's going on with him? Why is he? What's happening? I don't understand. It like the last two games, he's just, you cannot score anywhere near Derek Lively when he's near the basket. It's I need to check the numbers. How many blocks does he have? It's not enough.
Well, it's not only that, but I feel like guy like this is where PJ Washington's strength comes in, because he gets into the paint and all of a sudden his 7'3 arm span is there to block some people. Derek Jones Jr. is flying in to get some blocks with his ridiculous athleticism. Even like Daniel Gafford, I know it's not blocks, but I think in game three, the first 6 points the Mavericks scored were off his offensive rebounds. So they're just like cycling in these big dudes. And we talked about the fact that having offensive and defensive diversity is important in the playoffs. But then there are just times where, like you said, Derek Lively just like evolves mid-series, and it's like, actually, I'm uber Derek Lively now. How many blocks? Do you have the number right
now?
No,
I'm trying to look up what the rim percentage, the field goal percentage is when he's around. But this is the vision, right? This is the vision that you've seen, right? The sort of, this is why you are more of a believer. You're on the Mavs train, the Mavs bandwagon with all these guys after the trade. PJ Washington's really long. Derek Jones is really long. You have Gafford. You have Lively. Now they're enormous. Now they can defend and protect the paint. And by the way, I say hats off to them. And one thing I've learned and upgraded is just the toughness, just to respond to how they got hit in the mouth, because the Clippers have come out very physical. They're an athletic veteran team in the sense of not necessarily like speed up and down the court, but they hit the weight room, right? Let's leave it at that. They hit the weight room, okay? Mm-hmm. And so for them to be more physical, another guy you could buy a couple shares of stock in is Terrence Mann and what he's been able to do on the ball. I mean, they had the stat last game, like Luka's like 4 for 21 going into the game when guarded on Terrence Mann possessions. We did the video or the watch along after game one about how good he was mucking up screens and things like that. And the Mavs came back and they matched that physicality. And this has been one of the two most physical playoff series of the first round. And I think when you look at the way the game's been officiated for the last half decade, it's been one of the two most physical playoff series, I think, in 5 years, if not 10 years, if not 20 years. And a lot of that has been Dallas rising back to the occasion, and it comes full circle, because then when you get in the paint, you're just like, good luck getting a foul. It would be cool if you're the Clippers if you could get a foul, but apparently there's two options, a miss or a block. That's what's happening.
Can I give you some rim stats for the Clippers right now, Ben?
If you want the folks at home to commence the drinking game. Cody getting some rim numbers out. Cody, what do you got for us?
Cody's number corner.
What do you got from the stats department?
I need, Ben, I don't need you to sit down. I need everyone else to sit down, right? If you're driving, pull over for a second. If you're working, stop the bench press set, you know, rack it for a second. You can finish it in a moment. So the lowest rim field goal percentage for an offense during the regular season was the Portland Trail Blazers, who shot 60% at the rim. Okay, that was the lowest during the regular season. During these playoffs, in these four games, the Clippers are shooting 52% at the rim. 8 percentage points worse than the worst team in the NBA. Ben, let's go one step further. Very small sample size. I don't care. It's the theater. What does Shakespeare say? Something about all of us are merely players.
Life's a play or something.
Who cares? Shakespeare needs to sit down for this. When Zubats is on the bench, the Clippers are shooting 42% at the rim. 42%! At the rim when Zubats is on the bench. That's 18 percentage points worse than the Portland Trailblazers, who are the worst team in the regular season. This team, like, honestly, when you look at some of those numbers, you might as well just throw up some mid-range shots every possession. Like, that's more efficient than them getting to the rim right now. It's unbelievable. I can't believe any of those numbers. I can't believe it. Can't believe it, Ben.
Well, I found, again, small sample, because it's 20-something shots against them, according to the tracking data from Second Spectrum. But I found it. Derek Lively, in this series. Yes, this is for this, Cody, for anybody who's defended 10 field goals or more in the playoffs. This is first in the entire playoffs against Derek Lively. The Clippers are shooting 35% worse than expected when they're within 6 feet of the basket. 35%. Now, it's small sample. They needed to make, like, you know, four or five more shots, whatever it is. But that's first. That's first in the NBA in the playoffs, even with that small sample. So our eyes are not deceiving us. By the way, Jonathan Isaac is not too far behind him. If you want to tune in at the very end of the show for the last 2 minutes after we do the outro, we're going to have Cody do his magic hour. But, I mean, this series is I don't want to circle over or skirt over how well they've defended Luka Doncic and you know, Kyrie Irving to the rescue, basically, for Dallas's offense. But Dallas's defense, I think, has put them in a position where it's like, who would be next? Oklahoma City would be next?
Would it be?
Yeah.
I don't have the right.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's, you know, I think that's a huge box to check if I'm looking at that matchup going forward.
You made, not to put you on the spot with your own take, but you made a great point about Kyrie Irving and his way to score. Do you want to talk about just what Kyrie Irving is doing that's special scoring-wise? Maybe the aesthetics of his scoring game?
No, it's shot making. It's shot making.
His shot making.
Yeah. It's shot making, and you know, when you say that, there's a risk that you reduce everything down to the same dimension. Oh, he's a great shot maker. They're all the same. It's like, nah, it's very different. Good shot makers do it differently. And the thing about Kyrie that I think has been critical for them in this series is the pace with which he gets into his shots. So just like that sprinting into the catch-and-shoot three-pointer, pushing it in transition, and then flying up for one of those crazy pull-up threes. And when he's in rhythm and when he's feeling it, that adds that extra dimension. And then on top of that, as we've talked about ad nauseum, he can also run the offense when Luka's on the bench or when Luka's idling on the wing or something like that. So I think without him, I don't know where they would be, but 29 points per 75 over the first four games, plus 8% true shooting. He's just had some massive explosive stretches in one of these series where when you get in dogfights, when you get in rock fights in the playoffs, having a single player who can do that and explode for 30 or 35 points on that type of shot diet when the defense necessarily hasn't broken down, when the defense hasn't necessarily made a mistake or presented some huge vulnerability, I think it's invaluable. I mean, the Clippers are playing good defense and good defensive lineups, especially in the two games they haven't had Kawhi Leonard out there. And yes, they've both been victories, but I think for much of the series, Kyrie's shot making has been critical for the Mavs. And if that keeps up going forward, it's going to be incredibly important.
But even then, it's not flawless because, you know, he had 7 turnovers and it felt like any time he was getting in the paint, they were so good at just getting their hands in there and being physical with him. So, you know, even he's not immune from the Clippers' physicality and what they're able to do out there.
That's a good segue into the last series we need to talk about, which some people might say is the most physical playoff series in a decade or two. It's been blood in the garden, Cody. It's been a brawl.
Wow. Yes. It sounds like a great book title.
That would be a great book title. Yeah, you know, I would love Chris Herring, for someone like him to write a story about like the 90s Knicks and call it Blood in the Garden. That would be a really great read that we'd recommend.
Probably a New York Times bestseller right there.
That would be
great
such
idea.
A New York Times bestseller. We should go into book publishing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I actually should let you go first because I'm going to get hyperventilating talking about this series. This has been a war.
I don't even know where to start. This is such an intense game. This is one of the games yesterday where I had to watch, like, you know, usually I like to watch and rewind and whatever else, but for this one I was holding a baby during it, so I'm just sitting on the couch like rocking back and forth like, oh my god, look at all this craziness going on. Joel Embiid, I think, is probably where we have to start, who seems to be public enemy number one, especially for anyone living in New York. And I know there's been the video of him going around with a bunch of people are saying a dirty place, and a couple of them are pretty dirty. The play on Mitch Robinson wasn't the greatest look for him. But in terms of the on-court production,
I think that was a dirty play. Yeah.
Did I not? Okay, I should probably say that was very dirty. I think some of the other ones, you're like, I'm not sure. I could probably give him some grace on that, but Mitch Rob play is terrible.
All this stuff is like third rail now in basketball culture and with everything swirling around online and stuff. But it's like, to me, the number of truly dirty basketball players that I've seen at the professional level in my life, I would consider pretty small. I would consider it a pretty small list of players who I look at and I'm just like, oh yeah, you will consistently do dirty stuff. Like, that's way out of bounds. But there are other players, and maybe Embiid fits in this category, where from time to time you do things that you're like, okay, that individual play right there, mm-hmm. that's a dirty play. And just whether you're desperate or the moment, whatever it is, like, obviously we all know, don't grab a dude's legs when he's jumping. That's just out of bounds.
Yeah, that's it's kind of like the Giannis body checking Mike Dunleavy in like 2017 play
or whatever. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Not a dirty play, but that was undoubtedly a dirty play. Anyway, the thing that I'm drawn to when I watch the 76ers team is that the offense kind of reminds me of peak LeBron offenses, where it's humming. They have everything that they need to do. The entire offense is set around what this one individual guy is doing, but then the bench comes in. Like, the replacement comes in, and it completely changes what they're trying to do. Completely change. Like, they don't know how to run their offense functionally if Embiid's not on the court. And I think, you know, a lot of it has to do with Paul Reed comes in, and he lacks many of these offensive skills that Joel Embiid has. He can't space the floor, can't pass the ball like he does. He doesn't have the patience with the ball handling. I'm going to stop there because I'm a big Paul Reed fan. But he just can't replicate, like, anything Embiid does offensively. And when you look at the numbers, like, they're winning pretty handily the minutes that he's on the court. And I know people are going to point to the fourth quarter where Nick Nurse decided him to play like Tom Thibodeau minutes, right? And that's not ideal. You need to be calling timeouts for your guy. You probably need to let your 280, 300-pound dude that's coming off an injury to rest a little bit more. But regardless, he's a complete handful for the Knicks. And especially in the game when like Mitchell Robinson's not playing, they just really don't have a chance against what he's able to do out there. So to me, that's what I'm drawn to first when I'm watching this series.
I couldn't believe it. I thought Nick Nurse blew it by not calling. He had two timeouts down the stretch of that game. And I think this is a really subtle thing that we don't ever get a lot of attention on and a lot of analytics on and things like that because it's so rare. In these rare games where you play your stars the entire half, you need to think about managing fatigue differently. So you can't save your three timeouts for like, I want a challenge with 65 seconds left. I want to call two timeouts so I can advance the ball to half court. Those things are marginal compared to your best player who you're playing out there, because in the first four games of this series, Philadelphia has a plus 10 net rating per 100 with him on the court. That means if they play 400 possessions, they're winning by 40 points with him on the court. What happens when he goes to the bench? That net rating drops by 77 points. He has a plus 77 per 100 net rating over just a small sample. You have fun with small sample. But I think we have patreon.com/thinkingbasketball. One of our historical databases looks at playoff series stats by player. And I want to say off the top of my head, the best four-game series on-off ever is a Draymond Green series where he's plus 92. So it is small sample, but we are talking about something very extreme in terms of the swings. And since we've landed here, so the point there, by the way, is just Nurse needed to call at least one timeout down the stretch. He had a great opportunity where there was like a free throw and a challenge. Call the timeout there. Get yourself like a 5 or 6 minute real-life rest. You know, I couldn't believe you missed that. But this is now, Cody, in the last 6 years for Joel Embiid, the ninth time that he has not had a negative plus minus in a game and they lost the game. He has had a positive plus minus in every loss in this series. And so it kind of puts new meaning on, you have to tread water when your star goes to the bench. What happens when your star is off the court? Can you win those minutes? They've been getting crushed in those minutes historically. And this team, more than ever, was a fascination of mine. We just did the video at the end of the year that unfortunately has not been near the same health that we saw in his comeback at the very end of the season before he re-injured his knee against Orlando. This team depends entirely on his presence on offense and defense. The types of players that they have on offense and defense, the slashers, the cutters, the movers, it all goes away when he's off the court. It all goes away without his rim protection. He's not that mobile. So he had a huge rim protection game in game four, but the Knicks really attacked his lack of mobility on the outside, specifically Jalen Brunson, who was just a wizard. And the only reason we're this far into the podcast and haven't talked about him is because we just put up a video on the YouTube channel celebrating that wizardry. Oh, what a series.
So I think a really interesting analytics knowledge that we really don't have in the public domain that I'd love to see at team level stuff is each individual player's value per minute load. And what I mean by that is what players can you actually ramp up their minutes? Because I think that's something that people are like, oh, here's the superstar, ramp up the Joel Embiid, let's playing 47 minutes. Let's see what happens with him. And you just can't do that with some guys. Like Manu Ginobili, you go back to the Spurs in the playoffs, he never averaged more than like 36 minutes a game. Most of the time, he was like 32 minutes a game. Giannis, this was a whole discussion for a while. It's like, hey, why doesn't Bud play Giannis more than like 36 minutes a game? Because this is a guy that just goes out there and he gasses himself, just giving it all in that little bit of time. Now, Josh Hart, for instance, averaging 45 minutes per game in these playoffs, he can handle it. That's the kind of guy it's a different role from what Manu Ginobili and what Giannis are doing, but that's a guy that you can be like, go play me 48 minutes. And Josh Hart's like, great, I'm going to go for every offensive rebound ever.
It must have been one of the combination of like the trade and then OG Anunoby's injury, but Josh Hart has been playing 41 minutes a game for the last 2 months. No one plays that many minutes anymore in 2024, and he can absolutely do it. If there were a bet on this and the Knicks made it to the conference finals or the finals, Josh Hart getting tired and worn down at the end of this stretch is just not even, it should not be on the board. It is not an option. He can handle it. But to your point, it's a great point. So much of what we look at is rate statistics, per minute impact, per possession impact, things like that. And on a lot of the stuff I will compile personally and for our subscribers, you'll see this per game thing where I convert the number of minutes per game you play because I think that makes a big difference. But the point you're making here, Cody, is more subtle and maybe more practical than us just fantasizing about player value. It's like if you run a team, how do you know the optimal amount of time to play different players? And the answer is, we've been doing it by feel forever. We've just been doing it by gut and feedback. But is there some way to dial in? Maybe there's not, but is there some way to dial in on the reality, it seems, that some players do best at, some players do best at like 15 or 18 minutes because they can attack bench units. Some players do best at 30 minutes because they play with this explosive force and they can't sustain it. And then you get out into the Josh Hart, Allen Iverson territory, and you're just like, well, you can play 45 minutes in this game and not wear down. The Knicks feel like they get stronger at the end of this game or at the end of games in general. I'm kind of getting high on this, thinking about future playoff matchups and just like how far that can take them, just like wearing down. Like if they get a matchup with the Celtics in this tournament, and we get the combination of people freaking out over the Celtics' clutch offense and losing close games, and the Knicks just pounding people on the offensive glass in the fourth quarter, that's going to be, what does Martin Scorsese say? That's going to be cinema. That's going to be exciting.
I mean, anytime that offensive rebounding is back, that's just going to be the pinnacle. I would love to see the correlation of offensive rebounding in these playoffs, because it feels like offensive rebound's been very significant for everyone. Do you want to break down Jalen Brunson at all? Do you want to give a little bit of a sneak preview of anyone that hasn't seen the YouTube video, like myself, perhaps? What kinds of things did you notice that Jalen Brunson was doing in this game?
Before I do that, we've talked around it. We should explicitly say the 76ers were gassed at the end of that game. That was a huge issue. They were just totally gassed. I wanted to say that explicitly. Brunson, just very brief director's commentary. You know, check out the video, but the meta commentary for me and the titles I was playing with and the ideas I was playing with is like, this guy, for a short player, just has so many counters and tricks in his bag. That's the thing. And so the big theme of the video that you'll probably pick up on as you go through it is that he adjusts the way he's attacking based on what's in front of him. And we talk about basketball IQ and feel often as a holistic, you know, court mapping, 10 people on the court, how am I making passes and reading defenses and things like that. But there is an incredible intelligence, and we talked about this in the athleticism episode that we did a couple years ago with Evan Zoucha and Eric Leidersdorf, and talking about the cognitive side of the game and talking about soft athleticism skills. Jalen Brunson is sort of like a genius to me at reading what's in front of him and using these little micro moves and saying, okay, last time I leaned left and my defender leaned right, so this time I'm going to get him leaning right and trick him and go the other way. And you take that concept and you just apply it to like the entire series, where the beginning of the series was a grind, struggled to score, struggled to deal with the length. They threw a ton of coverages at him. He said, okay, I'm going to try to pass out of these coverages and create for my teammates. The offense has been plenty good for the Knicks. But in the last two games, Cody, he's started to dial in the rhythm with the scoring. And it comes from this place of like, okay, big guy on me, take him over here. Can I get to a step back in a little shooting pocket? Okay, they're going to send extra help at me. I'm going to pass it, get off the ball, move, shift the defense that way, create offense. Oh, now I got the high screen. They didn't send extra help. I have the big one-on-one in space. Here comes the Brunson back. All right, you're just going to get the shifty left, jab, cross, spin, up, fake, juke. Oh, you want to play isolation? Now I'm going to go into my isolation back. Now I'm going to give you the back you down, spin, Michael Jordan, fade away over you. It's just the feel and the intelligence to go to those different skills depending on what the heck the Philadelphia defense is throwing at him. And the last point is in the post-game presser, his coach was talking about defending Embiid. And he's like, great players, you don't want to show them the same thing. You want to show them different coverages. If you show them the same thing, they'll learn it. It gets too repetitive. And I think the Knicks and Tibbs have carried that over on offense and defense, where offensively for Brunson, they're just breaking out different things. Off-ball movement, double screen high, single pick and roll, try to hunt Maxi, and mixing that up. And he's such a perfect player to do that because he has a different speed pitch for every one of those at-bats.
So if let's say we're assuming that they're going to win the series and the Celtics move on, do you think that this Knicks team, based on the way how they play, Jalen Brunson's brilliance and being able to respond to defensive coverages like that, do you think they can make it an interesting second-round series?
It would be a third-round series. Yeah.
Wait, who are they playing in the second round?
The second round series will
be, yes. Oh, my goodness. How could I forget, Ben? Oh, my goodness. I got ahead of myself here.
I like
here.
What you did there.
I got ahead of myself here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a good it's a good segue, Cody, for before we end the show, for you to get your 2 minutes in on the Orlando Magic, who had – please tell me you saw it. Please tell me you saw the third quarter.
I watched the third quarter.
Oh, my God. They had a 37-10. That's what it's called in Florida. The third quarter. 37-10 third quarter against the Cavs, which was – it was sort of the – when you think of Cody's fever dream of watching the Orlando Magic play and everything that they are, seven defenders flying around on the ball and forcing turnovers and getting out in transition and making threes, and it was spectacular. Now it's 2-2.
I mean, it's the exact kind of situation you don't want to see as the opposite team. Because the Cavaliers, I don't think they scored the last 5 minutes of that third quarter. Like, Jalen Suggs was just everywhere, just hounding Donovan Mitchell, just doing it. Isaac's down there protecting the rim. It's incredible what they were able to do. And they were just flying through, like, flinging threes from all over the place. Jonathan Isaac's throwing in putback dunks. He's hitting threes. I think in the fourth quarter, he banked in a three. Everyone's just getting in on the fun. I don't even remember how it all kicked off, but I don't know, man. That I don't know what I should say about this series beyond it just seems like whichever team's going to decide to make shots that particular game is going to win that game. Like, that really seems to be what it's boiled down to at this point.
So you're not bought in that the Magic being plus 18 per 100 with Franz Wagner on the court through the first four games of the series, you're not bought in that that's a good future indicator that they can take two of the final three here.
I mean, I did ultimately pick the Magic at the beginning of this series because I just the Cavs have been struggling so mightily. I don't know. I'm going to say sure, like that is a good indicator. But then if Donovan Mitchell comes out and pretends it's 2021 again or 2020 again and just averages 50 points a game for these next few, like sure, like that's going to end the series. Or Max Strus decides to make a bunch of threes, or Darius Garland's going to be on top, or Evan Mobley decides to start burying those corner threes. That's going to shift the series. And I hate to be so reductive about it, but this feels like the series where it's just like, who's going to make the shots? That team's going to win that game.
To support us, patreon.com/thinkingbasketball. It's the best way to do it. Cody, any other final thoughts? I don't know. I'm supposed to do an outro, but I can't remember.
Well, I think we should do a fun thing now that you started the outro to just comment really briefly on the other series that we didn't talk about.
Oh, we're going to do our rapid fire.
Yeah, can we do a rapid fire to end this?
Yes. Celtics Heat. Go ahead.
Just end the series already. Like, stop this. This is nonsense.
So you're not going to get intrigued if it's 2-2 going back to Boston, where Miami is like 17-2 in the playoffs in the last 4 years.
I'm going to look at all the other playoff games I want to watch and go, fine. Like, that's how I'm going to feel. Just end the series already.
I have a confession. I have a confession to make.
Oh my goodness. Yes.
I'm really starting to enjoy watching the Heat Celtics games.
Oh my god!
Yeah,
what are you enjoying about them?
They're just so well coached. Miami is just so they're so good at fundamentals, and they make stuff difficult for you. And the Celtics, as great as they are, obviously have a little bit of swinginess to them. They have a little bit of a higher variability style where we've looked at that three-point shooting, of course, and it's just like, well, all right, what happens if they have a game where they shoot 29 or 32% on their threes? The Heat, on the other hand, and I think this has to do with the coaching, like they can generate these playoff games where they make half their threes like they did the other night. So I don't know. I really miss Jimmy Butler in this series. Yeah,
that would make me a lot more interested. Bam being so flexible defensively is super interesting, but I kind of want this to be over with, Ben.
All right, well, it's rapid fire, so we have to move on.
All right, okay. Thunder Pelicans.
Thunder Pelicans. This series needs to be over. Oh.
Inner circle team.
I need the next challenge. This is not a real challenge. This is a warm up. This is what we needed for the Thunder. This is a warm-up, and now we need a bigger, better challenge in front of them.
And as far as I'm concerned, those are all the playoff series. I think we've touched on every matchup for this first round.
That's it. Those are all of the series. We are definitely not forgetting any series at all taking place in the Midwest. We've covered all of the NBA playoff series, all seven of them, all seven series.
Yes. It's a weird season where they just played seven.
That in-season tournament, it messed up the bracket at the end of the year. Thanks for listening to this one all the way through. Hope you're enjoying these games as much as we are. And as always, that you are having a great day.